That's how the light gets in.
Welcome to Gnosecast, the Gnostic podcast, with the Reverend Troy Pierce, where questions make heretics. Views expressed in this podcast are those of the speaker.
Ring a bell, let's still ring.
Go ahead and get started. First of all, hello. Thanks for coming. Hope you're ready for a conversation in addition to a presentation. This is an experiment at having a different conversation on the Da Vinci Code. And so, you ready with questions and comments, concerns, irrelevant details, boring stories, whatever you have. This is going to be the first of three seminars on this particular topic, and the first of a number of series of seminars that will be sponsored by the Gnosis Institute and the Gnostic Society. And there's information available on the table about all of these things. The Gnosis Institute is a non-profit educational research institution that is just getting underway. We'll be offering degree programs in a few fields and public events and seminars such as this. The Wasatch Gnostic Society has been holding lectures and events in this area for about the past decade. And the Ecclesia Gnostica is the Gnostic Church, has also been holding regular services in the area for the past decade. These were both started in the Los Angeles area. The Gnostic Society, I believe, in 1928, and the Ecclesia Gnostica in 1959. Been around for quite some time. If you have any questions about any of these things, feel free to bring them up afterwards, during, whenever it seems appropriate. The reason we're here is the Da Vinci Code phenomenon. And it is one that is filled with quite a few odd coincidences, ironies, and a lot of other things. And one of the ones that is a very unintentional and unpleasant irony is that we find ourselves here the day after the September 11th, 5th anniversary. Well, there is no connection between these two things. The way in which we look at religion and look at controversies and have conversations about these things are important. We will always stand in the shadow of that event. And so, standing in the shadow, we must seek the light. Over the past 5 years, there have been numerous calls for religious understanding, interreligious understanding. But also over 5 years, we've had more and more divisiveness, more and more polarization, less conversation. And so calls for understanding aren't enough. We need to engage in that process, begin to see what other people are seeing in these things, and to find a means and a language which we can communicate and look at understandings of religion and beliefs that aren't merely contentious. Basically, it comes down to a fairly simple question. How do we respond to someone else's religious or spiritual experiences or concerns? Do we need to dismiss those in order to make our own experiences and concerns and beliefs have more value? Or can we merely look and understand those of somebody else. There's also a fear that if we really understand the point of view of somebody else, that we will somehow alter our own. We are somehow also devaluing our own. Another concern is that any consideration will be considered an attack. That these sacred stories, these things, are off limits and shouldn't discuss politics and religion. These are contentious things. And that any approach to these stories, any approach to these sacred beliefs, closely held beliefs, will be perceived as an attack, and that there will be a response, a counterattack. The way I'm going to propose to look at these things, and that we will begin, hopefully, conversing about these things, is as stories. A story is merely form. It is a structure of understanding. When we look out at the world, the way we make sense of all the data that we are seeing out there is as stories. We don't want to have merely a data dump, a whole lot of information. We want a story. We want a summary. We want somebody to make it meaningful to us so that we can understand it. Or we do that ourselves. Now, a story being a form says nothing about whether this subject of the story or the telling of the story is true or not. It's just a form. It's like a book or a movie. It doesn't tell you whether it's a comedy or a documentary, whether the book is fiction or nonfiction or history. The story is merely frame, way of understanding. And so I'm going to propose that this is a way that we can look at these sacred stories as stories and not get caught up in issues of whether or not they're factual or true or needing to believe them the same way to get along.
Are you implying in that definition that we view them as fiction?
No.
Okay.
No. A story is merely a story. We tell stories about our history. We tell stories about the founding of this country, for example. And those do not mean that we are telling fictional accounts, but we are telling stories. So to tell a story means you will take certain data and certain characters and you will link them together. You will have a meaning. You will be going someplace. If they don't go someplace, then what's the point? You don't really understand what's going on. It's just a bunch of facts and data. The characters don't resonate with you, and they're just names, places, events. But if history is told well, then it is told as a compelling story, one that you can enter into and see. In telling a story, you don't give all of the information of what happened. Now, you don't list the details of when everybody was born, what they had for lunch, everything that happened beforehand to lead to that point in history. If you were telling the story of a battle or of the signing of the Constitution or something, instead you pick out particular threads and you link them together in a story. They say that that doesn't say whether it's a fictional account or not. Because having a book or a movie tells you nothing about whether the book is true, is historical, or not. And so, by looking at the form, we can essentially bypass some of the contention and actually have a conversation. But seeing the form, as they say, doesn't imply anything about truth claims, truth veracity, etc. It's just a way of looking at things and the way we understand things. And actually, the primary way in which most of Christianity understands its central message is the greatest story ever told. And that isn't to say that believing Christians going out their missionary efforts believe it's fiction. They just see it that it is a story. And this is how this meaning is conveyed. You can't really understand why someone might go out and believe these things without some sort of a story. It's as if you can't understand Islam without the story of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, or Buddhism without the story of the Buddha, Prince Siddhartha. These stories are the central framing structures of religion and of faith, because stories are always the way in which we frame meaning. There isn't a story, it doesn't have any meaning. So stories are central to our ability to understand, both how we understand the world and how we understand ourselves, because we often see ourselves as living out a particular story, our story. We see ourselves as being the hero of our story, some of us see ourselves as being more of an extra. That's a personal thing. But we are living out stories. So with that, keeping that in mind, and keeping in mind the importance of being able to have these conversations and being able to have some means of approaching these things, let's turn our attention to this odd phenomenon. The odd phenomenon is, of course, the Da Vinci Code. It's a novel that is classed as a mystery thriller, basically as a pulp fiction novel, pretty described as an airport read or as a beach read. And that is its structure as fiction. And that isn't really the whole reason why it has become popular. It essentially became a runaway bestseller because people were recommending it to each other and talking about it and really very engaged with the backstories involved in the novel. This popularity boom led to a number of different responses. We're familiar with these, the set the record straight, debunking crowd, which is pointing out the very many errors in the novel. And then there is sort of the other camp, which is the truth behind the fiction camp, which largely consists of these individuals who wrote the book upon which the novel is based. Of individuals like the authors of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and the Templar Revelation, and so forth, trying to show that there is something behind this. And these have grown into two cottage industries and really piqued a lot of interest. Indeed, if you want to get people really interested in something, decry it, debunk it, try to keep people from reading it, and they'll get really interested, and they'll start reading it. Well, we have this response, and it's kind of taken off guard, and mostly academics, and there's like this religious response to set the record straight. But where this really gets concerted is coming up to the movie, because they know the movie is coming out. And so we have these large, concerted efforts to try to get there beforehand, before people see the movie, and to disabuse them of what they might otherwise be deceived of as being facts. Now, the irony of this is that, of course,
It merely reinforces the earlier message that there is some sort of movement to suppress this information, which makes it much more interesting. Makes us want to read it all the more. And these responses aren't very consistent either. They merely are looking for one thread, one area, one way of looking at it. So, really, after looking at all those things, you're still left wondering why. Why was there this controversy, this phenomenon? Why is this such an appealing work? We're at the tail end of this, and we're at a point in the story where things have changed, where the story that we are given, with which we should understand these things, is as a fad, as one of those inexplicable cultural explosions that occur, that discombobulate everything for a short time, and then fade away until the next one comes along. But even if we accept that characterization, it doesn't get at the meaning of why this has appealed to so many people, and why it still does. So, take a second here and see what you think. How many people here are enjoyers of the novel, the movie? Did you like it? Any hands up? Come on. Many people disliked it? Didn't really enjoy it? Okay, now for the more interesting question is if you can frame in one or two sentences why you liked or disliked it. Anybody wants to attempt this? Go ahead.
After a long delay, I just read a book this past weekend because I've been wanting to for a long time and I kind of thought it would tie into this book. But I like the book because I'm a real spiritual person and have been a Christian for a long time. But I'm a truth person and I'm always stimulated to seek for truth. So I like a lot of the background things that were given in the book. The detail was, I found very, just very stimulating and mind-opening.
Okay.
And when I then went and saw the movie the other night, and I was disappointed after I read the book because I felt like so much was missing from the movie, and I'm glad I had read the book, or I don't think I would have gotten the greatest understanding from just seeing the film. That's my opinion.
Anybody else? Oh, come on, don't be shy. Yeah.
Actually, I read the book that I felt when I did it, I wasn't sure, but it ended like it was only special people that wrote these sentences. Was it about a little tribe or something?
Yeah, we'll get to that. It's
at the end, I got the phone, they were trying to say that it's just a little tribe of people that are descendants of this story. But I would think that it would be the crop of low descendants of Aaron and Jesus.
Look at that. Anybody else?
I like the popularization of the alternative views of Christianity that have been out for a while, and here we have two different, one negative type of Christianity that isn't necessarily Christianity for Canada, but there's a lot of different points of view out there. It's nice to see something that's a lot of the flesh there.
Yeah.
things that I stopped on the
to it enthusiastically and thoroughly disliked it. Just not liking that whole genre, and then further just, you know, having pet peeves as to the inaccuracies and so forth. But then as other people's reactions, you know, other people talk to me about it and their reactions, and I reread it a few times, I could see that there were two things going on. There's a whole lot of things actually going on in there. And that's what we're going to try to do, is just tease out some of these different threads. There's a lot of reasons to like and dislike the book and the movie, but mostly the book. As you said, the movie takes quite a few turns. It cuts down the story and actually makes it a lot more believable, so that it is much more less in this fictionalized world and more in our world. So the professor is more skeptical. These things aren't accepted as facts. And there is quite a bit of a difference. There isn't this backstory isn't quite so large. And a lot of the inaccuracies are cut out, corrected, or put in the mouth of the insane character. So
there's
a lot of changes.
Do you think the inaccuracies were taken out?
A number of them were, yes.
Okay.
Yes. So they had basically 3 years to hear the criticisms and respond. Largely the criticisms seem to be of nature of looking for the feet of clay. So we have this novel, this story, that, you know, sort of the little novel that could, it grew into this huge giant, huge phenomenon, and then there are a number of specialists taking aim with their slingshots and trying to find the chink in the armor, the feet of clay, and take down the giant. None of them succeed. Zero looking at different points of data in the story. They're not looking at the story itself. Only a few criticisms I've come across, and I've dug pretty deeply, have any awareness of some of the arching backstory and how that ties into these things. And so, if you're just aiming at chinks in the armor, and not at the whole, looking at the whole story and the structure of the story, which is actually interwoven stories, then the only thing you're doing really is confirming people and their opinions who dislike the story, that it has no foundation. And those who like the story, well, we all have stories that we like, might believe, might retell, but there are inaccuracies too. And so that doesn't really remove the story, the net effect of this attempting to debunk hasn't been very much, except for, as I say, there's a change in a lot of content in the movie. Now, instead of doing what those things do, which is looking one by one at all the different facts and so forth, and there are like 40 different books you can go out there and find on that if you're interested, we're going to look at these stories. And there are sort of interwoven threads of stories. This is just a quick schematic that looks at some of the major threads in the backstory that Dan Brown uses. These are in three major threads. And they actually do interrelate in a way that makes good sense to link them together in a fictional story and makes it quite persuasive. These stories are essentially the Holy Blood, Holy Grail story, which has expanded and grown and become something of its own movement in a lot of ways. And this has a lot of different impulses to it. But in the novel, this becomes the thread for most of the action. And there are Grail documents, there are the remains of Mary Magdalene, there is this marriage that was suppressed, kept hidden, and there is this continuing bloodline. This sets you up for there to be a conflict with essentially the Roman Catholic Church, because even though a lot of it takes place further back in history, that's the structure and archetype that Dan Brown is using as the archetype for Orthodox Christianity. And when we look at that, really that's what we think of, because it's the oldest in the West, goes back a long time, and it's just archetypally in our culture and in our imaginations, that's what it is. This conflict between this Grail information and the powers that be lead to exploitation for cash, in the case of the Templars, suppression, destruction of the Templars, a lot of things. And this secret society conspiracy to preserve these documents and this bloodline from this oppressive force of the powers that be. The second story, sort of the shadow side of Christian origins. And this is some of the information that a lot of people really didn't know. Most of the details, okay, there might be some details that are accurate in the novel about these things, but
what did you say?
Trying to think. They come to mind. But essentially everything I can think of is inaccurate as far as details go in the novel.
Inaccurate.
Inaccurate.
About this one?
About the, Christian origins. What he's telling are stories, but the details he's using aren't historical facts. And so he's characterizing things broadly that do have a historical story. But the facts he's using are more like Reagan-era factoids. They're not historical facts. They're quick and dirty ways of saying this is what went into this here. So instead of saying that church politics shaped doctrine, by the novel he makes it all about the Emperor Constantine, shaping church doctrine, shaping the canon. And he compiles things that occur over centuries into one event. The problem with doing this, of course, is that if you look in your history book, then you'll see that these details are wrong. And when you look at the debunkers, they'll show you that they're wrong. However, that doesn't say anything about the story that he's really kind of characterizing and referring to that's behind that, that there's truth to. But it isn't a simple truth, and it isn't a simple story with just a couple of characters. It also isn't just a black and white story, either. So, there's a story of Christianity coming into a relationship with imperial power, and over many centuries, essentially becoming an imperial power in Western Europe. We see this consolidation of power in the formation of the canon, in the Crusades, in the Inquisitions. And all these he sees as being means of suppressing this knowledge, this grail knowledge, and this hidden knowledge of this relationship of Christ to Mary Magdalene. Also in his account is another fairly large flawed issue, and that is he asserts that Jesus was not considered divine until the Council of Nicaea, and this was pushed forward. And of course, this also is incorrect. However, I say that the detail is incorrect and very wrong, but the story, of course, is broader and richer. There were many different stories, many different ways to understand Christ, to understand Jesus. And these began very early on. These were not later made-up additions, but the people there understood these things in different ways. And they told stories. They passed on their understanding through stories. And we have a number of those stories. We had four for a very long time. Now, the Gospels are actually four different stories. The way our modern minds and the way modern theologians talk about these things is to try to harmonize them all together into one story, to make one story out of it. And so, instead of the things that occur only in John, only occurring in John, and the things that occur only in Luke, only occurring in Luke, what we have are these combination stories. So a Christmas pageant that includes accounts from different Gospels. Holy Week and Easter that includes accounts from all the different Gospels. And we combine this into one story in our modern age. But that also was an impulse that began very early on. It was an early attempt to harmonize the Gospels into one account. It was rejected. And so, in a way, in looking at these things and in telling this tale very simply and quickly, because it is backstory to his story, he gave ammunition to those who want to dismiss the whole notion of this diversity and of this political shaping of doctrine. Ammunition to dismiss it all because of these historical inaccuracies that are a part of the story that Dan Brown writes. Now the last story that he weaves through that we're going to look at sort of in a smaller frame, and we'll look at a larger frame next week. And that is what has been characterized as the goddess movement story. And this is a story that essentially grew up in the 20th century and is recounted in the novel. It has very similar characteristics to the Christian Oregon story in that there are true stories one can tell about some of these things, but the story as is told is not an accurate one. And in the Scottish Movement story, it was essentially kind of a golden age of paganism before the advent of Christianity. And this golden age, there was the goddess, or in some accounts, there was both god and goddess. It was a balance of some kind. Yet oddly enough, in almost all of these accounts, that balance is just kind of lip service, and the god just kind of fades away. So this is, already has kind of this golden age aura to it. And that this transition into a monotheism, into a patriarchy, led to this cultural shift, to a lot of problems that we have, and has been essentially the reason for a lot of suppression of women over the ages. And the novel, Brown points out the inquisition of women as witches, and points to that as being the trial of women by celibate male clergy. Now from that story seems to come the importance of Mary Magdalene, because it doesn't seem to come from anywhere else. And essentially the story he tells is pretty large. So we'll get into two more of it next week. But he brings forward that the female is divine because the female gives birth. And that the way the male can approach divinity is only through the female. So what we have is this odd connection that I've only seen one other person mention, that Jesus is not divine and the importance of Mary Magdalene just kind of don't go together. This is one of those points we can really see that he's weaving together different stories. I meant to stop there a few times, but I just kept talking. Yes, you interrupt me. Interrupt me now. Yeah.
I'm personally interested in your representative of the Gnostic religion, which is a very ancient religion. Which of those storylines would the Gnostic religion most support?
The one that we really fit into and why we got kind of dragged into this debate is the Christian origins. Because Gnosticism was there at the very beginning of Christianity, and the formation of Christianity really occurred in this sort of debate and consideration between different Christian movements, and what became proto-orthodoxy began to write critiques of what it considered to be these heretical movements. And the first big critique of these labeled them as Gnostic. And there are different ways of looking at that label Gnostic. But the derogatory way is that, you know, they're the know-it-alls, you know, that this is all intellectual knowledge. However, Gnosis in Greek is a type of knowledge. It's a type of knowledge that you come by only through experience. So you would have Gnosis of someone. Knowing someone would be Gnosis.
Which Bible do they use? Do they use the sacred Bible, the Holy Bible, the King James Version? Do they use the Bible?
Yes. There are actually many texts. And so what Gnostics, modern Gnostics, tend to do are to use all the texts to some degree. Some of the apocryphal texts are really silly, not a whole lot of useful things to them. The infancy Gospel of Thomas is one of those, but what's that?
I'm sorry, were you saying that you felt like parts of the Bible were not appropriate, or?
No, the apocryphal texts.
Apocryphal.
Yeah, some of the texts that get labeled as Gnostic are just that because they're apocryphal, they're not part of the canon. And they don't really seem to have anything to do with Gnosticism. So. Well, it's not really about belief. So it isn't accepting particular stances of belief. It's more of this approach to knowing through experience. And so it's really this radically different approach that Orthodoxy kind of left behind and that keeps cropping up and is really what seems to be a lot of people are missing from the religious experience now, is this personal experience notion. Because we have this tendency to look at religion today as abstract, objective, as if, you know, you can have a religion that nobody belongs to. And from the Gnostic perspective, that's nonsense. You know, it's subjective. It always involves the subject and the person. And so that fits into this Christian origin story because there were various movements. They weren't large. They weren't the major force. And one of the stories that is told in the novel is that these texts were suppressed because they contained information about the marriage of Christ to Mary Magdalene. Of course, they don't. They weren't suppressed for those particular reasons. And there wasn't a whole lot of active suppression anyway. These were never large movements. And these texts can be quite esoteric and hard to understand. And so, you say the story is richer and broader, but there is this backstory that is real behind that one, for certain. Any other comments, interruptions? Continue on.
In the Bible about Gnostics or something?
There are references in Paul's letter. I mean, basically, it's a Greek word, so it just means knowers. But it's a particular type of knower, so somebody who's acquainted with. So like a guide to a terrain or something, somebody who knows that terrain would have gnosis of it.
When you review that word, gnosis, as far as an experiential knowledge, what are you referring to?
In English, that has been used to mean knowledge of the divine. So instead of having book knowledge from scriptures or from reading a theological text or something, what Gnostic seeks is that more that mystical experience, immediate thing.
That's what our understanding.
Yes.
Would you acquaint with
you? No. There are quite a few similarities, but there is also the difference is sort of a larger difference. So on a smaller scale, you could see the two as being the same, but in the larger scale, the mystic is within a particular religious story and doesn't contradict that story, whereas a Gnostic isn't within a particular story. Gnostic, and that's one of the things that annoyed early church fathers, was that they would tell their own stories and they would retell stories. And so there is a difference in that. A mystic approaches this experience, but their context is like that of their Orthodox brothers and sisters. A Gnostic approaches these things and is not limited to that one story and their understanding. So.
Just one more question.
Sure.
The Book of Mary, do you accept that as, do you believe that that's true?
Oh, I don't have weeks of truth. the way that Orthodox churches and stuff would like accept the Bible as being the Word of God and stuff, we don't go even close to there. These texts are stories that come from people's experiences, and they come from people's understandings. Right. So essentially, it's a means of conveying gnosis. Because gnosis is something like an acquaintanceship, an experience. You can't convey it directly and say, here, know Fred. You have to tell a story. You have to put it in a framework. And so, from a Gnostic perspective, the sacred stories and texts are means of conveying that inner experience. And once you get to that inner experience, then you've understood them. But until then, you don't.
In the Gnostic religion, okay, it's been all male society since way back at the beginning. Have there ever been women in it?
Oh, they always have been. Yeah, it's also one of the things that early church fathers were annoyed about, was the fact that women were allowed to teach and preach and were allowed to join without their husbands. And there is a large... Yes. Yes, it was probably not entirely egalitarian because of the times, but it was more so than the standard, the other more orthodox approaches or proto-orthodox approaches. Anybody else? Shall we go on? He fulfilled the story. He lived out his story.
No, it's a parable of the teachings of Christ himself. Could be interpreted
by
the
Bible. Oh, certainly.
To maintain the Bible, the same Bible for everyone. And Christ even put the teachings forward with a certain attention and a certain...
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, we probably would look at this point, is that even if you have a set doctrine, a set belief structure, accepted story, that doesn't mean that you have a uniformity. There isn't a uniformity in orthodoxy. You know, we're just more open about it in the fringe where I'm at, but being able to recite the same creed, read the same texts for edification, doesn't mean you understand them in the same way. And so, even this movement towards an orthodoxy, you still have continually different heresies cropping up. Different understandings that then has to be responded to, decided between, and a choice made. And essentially this is the way history has simply unfolded itself. That's what happens when you have an orthodox strategy for religion. So we had the initial formation of orthodoxy was against the initial heresy proclaimed of Gnosticism. And then you go less than a generation and you have Arianism and you have various and other heresies as you go along. And so if you try to control the story, if you try to control what is considered to be fact or history, then you are always working hard to try to control that. And that really is the truth behind some of this oppression, suppression story that we get in this shadow side of Christian origins. That there were oppressions, there were inquisitions, there was a crusade against Christians. And if you take that tack of orthodoxy, that's where you will end up.
Can I just ask you, you said you have the three headings across the top.
Mm-hmm.
Do these horizontal rows have particular headings as far as what you're categorizing in each one of those sections?
Not really. They're just kind of how you link these things together. So this is just a looking at the weaving of the stories within the novel, The Da Vinci Code. And the way that Dan Brown saw these different threads and stories, and the way he linked them together is essentially across this horizontal line. So the Grail, this marriage, he links to this lost sacred feminine. And he links to the suppression of which by church power. Yeah. And so there's, they say that the stories, as they're told vertically have linking points. And he saw those and he linked them together. The story behind these stories is richer and also harder to dismiss and debunk. And that's one of the more interesting things we'll be talking about. Yes. What is around our revival groups? Yeah, exactly. They revived the Templar order, but the order of the Templars was destroyed. Went out in an edict in 1307 on Friday the 13th to arrest them all and question them under torture on charges of heresy. And essentially that's what happened. It was slower to happen in England. Apparently it never happened in France, in Scotland, which is one of the reasons why there are speculated in some fairly compelling links to Masonic origins. But nothing is known. No. No. The Templars were a direct result of the Crusades. And it was 3 or 4 knights, I think it was 3 to begin with, and that they quickly had a 4th. And there were knights who had gone through the Crusades, they'd conquered Jerusalem, and they were just kind of sick of that. They wanted something a bit more spiritual, religious, and they formed a religious military order. So basically they were knights who became monks. And their duty as a religious order was to protect pilgrims to the Holy Land. Now this expanded greatly because protecting pilgrims can be a pretty big business, you know. You need a big army, that's a lot of real estate. Plus, if you really want to help pilgrims, help them by not having them carry all their money with them, right? You take their money from them, give them a little banknote, charge them a little bit of interest. They can take that to the Holy Land, withdraw their money from a Templar bank there. And so essentially the Templars grew in power, prestige, and became one of the major armies of the Crusades. And after the Crusades were over, which is when they were destroyed, there was a lot of question as to, do we still need these guys around? Do we still need these 2 crusading orders, the Templars and the Hospitallers? So even before these charges of heresy, which almost all scholars agree are trumped up, not all, before that happened, there was a lot of kind of wondering as to, do we still need the Templars around? They were the larger of the 2 orders, had the most money. More kings owed them money, particularly Philippe the Fair, who was the king of France, who instigated their trial. And so they weren't in a good position at the time. There are a lot of interesting mysteries around the Templars. A lot of reasons to think that there were some interesting things they picked up in the Holy Land. But there's no actual evidence. We just have some interesting stories, interesting hints, but no meat. Other questions, responses? Go ahead.
I just keep having questions. The Gnostic sect again, they believe that Christ was simple? Is there a possibility of the mirror?
Oh, there's no standard beliefs. Whatever you believe. You know, it's a personal thing.
No, I'm just talking about if Christ would have been married.
That is actually one of the big questions and one of the big interesting things that isn't on this little weaving together, is that what would it mean one way or the other? And really, that's one of the things we're going to look at next week. We can start talking about it now, because what would it be? Really, the more, I think, stronger theological statement is that Jesus wasn't considered to be divine, but that can be kind of overlooked because it's such a strong statement. I mean, you got a lot of people who just want to accept or look at the marriage possibilities. So you have people like Margaret Starbird and so forth who want to look at that aspect. And there are reasons why this appeals. There is an ancient symbol, the hieros gamos, the sacred marriage. And it seems to be that symbol that people are looking for when they pair up Mary Magdalene and Jesus Christ. That they want to see this balance again. But the reason they're doing that is because the way the story has been used previously. The celibacy, the singlehood of Christ, the maleness of all the 12 disciples, all that has been used to keep women out of religious hierarchy. And so there's this attempt to swing the pendulum back, move it back across. But it doesn't have to go in that way or there, because there really is no reason to take the original story as meaning that anyway. And that's the big point of our third evening is really looking at why that occurred and why it shouldn't have been used for that, those purposes all along, essentially. And that, again, is one of those underlying threads of that central story there, the shadow history, is that there were cultural, religious marginalization of women. But it didn't start there. It didn't start with Christianity, which is part of this other story, and why that is more of a myth, that golden age. Yep. Anybody wants a thing, or should I?
My husband and I have a sermon for
the Templars. Yeah, we have a service for the Templars on October the 13th, which will be Friday this year, which will be followed with a party this year. So
you can celebrate the day tomorrow.
Well, no, the service is going to be a Vespers for Martyrs. The party is just a good excuse for a party. To fix a broken thing by going to the other extreme. And, friend Stephen Heller calls it, rebaptized Ms. Jehovah. You know, it's just having a goddess only. That you're just having this other orthodoxy. You're having a different orthodoxy, but it's still an orthodoxy. It's still one story, one thing, and it's not open to your experience and your participation. And so that really has been just a swinging back, an overreaction in a lot of ways, that really until this novel had almost faded out of popular culture. This came into most popular culture, fringe culture, in the late 70s, into the early 80s, and it started to kind of fade out in the 90s, and was almost gone until The Da Vinci Code brought it back.
I don't know if anyone can take it. Yeah.
No, but the story, they don't believe the story anymore. They don't believe this golden age matriarchy because there isn't any evidence for it. Yeah, but there has never been a golden age in historical human history, so it is a
symbol.
Yes, well, it becomes a symbol. That's why it becomes a myth and a story, and then it becomes because something you can actually use and talk about. Whereas if you look at his history again, like all of this stuff, if you look at this as history, you can find out and pick off every one of these points for historical inaccuracy in the novel. He's wrong about every single one of them. Yeah, well, I see it as being an attempt to have redress an unbalance, but it's framing it in a particular way that doesn't seem all that useful. Like I say, it was pretty much abandoned. Well, fairly recent, you know, he brought it back to life, essentially. The story of Dan Brown's story, of his story, has actually changed a bit over time. Early interviews, when asked what was true, what was accurate, he would say all of it. More recently, it's more of it could have been happened, it could have been true. And essentially, it seems to reflect his own personal beliefs, his own personal exploration and journey, which is why it seems to appeal to so many people. You can't intentionally write something that appeals to this many people. You try, but of course, people fail. The reason it appeals is because there's something that resonates within us to that story. Essentially, there is the story within us that may have been unexpressed and untold until we see a narrative and a story that expresses that for us, or expresses parts of it for us. And that, I see, is really the power of the Da Vinci Code in our culture. Is that by going on this personal journey, this personal quest, belief, that with all of its flaws and all of the idiosyncrasies of personal belief, because what we choose to believe for various different reasons. And we all have our own criteria for how we might choose to believe things. But by sort of taking us on that journey makes for a more compelling story. And he adds to that a lot of other things, a lot of attempts to persuade, and then what I would call cheats and conceits, playing with the facts, playing with the setting, and so forth. But there does seem to be this vital sense of a personal quest growing in the heart of the novel that appeals to people. So even if various aspects of the story, even if almost all of the facts are wrong, there's still reason to pay attention, a reason to be interested, and to listen to what the story has to say. Primarily, where you want to listen is within yourself, to see where you are completing the story. The story is only half told, is only partly told, as some of these stories are in the novel. We have a tendency to fill in the blanks. We have a tendency to connect the dots. And if we are doing that, that means the story isn't out there. The story isn't just in the book. The story is also within us. And if a story really resonates with us, really opens things up, really hits home, hits deeply, then that story is definitely deeply within us. The psychological term would be a psychological complex, as Jung would term it, which isn't a negative term, again, it's more like story. It's just a pattern within us. And we can see these patterns in each other, across time, across space, across human beings. These are universal human. And this takes us to another layer beneath this backstory, these connections, to the code, to the symbols, to these linkings across time, across artworks, and seeing these connections of symbols, and seeing them as telling one story. Carl Jung made a distinction between symbol and sign. Sign, it's like a street sign, it's just a code. It's like Lee Dan Brown uses Da Vinci Code, which he copied from Templar Legacy. You can see a sign as merely meaning one thing. The stop sign means stop. There's a whole lot of other interpretations available to you. But a symbol is richer and deeper. A symbol doesn't only mean one thing. Symbol means many things. It's open to interpretation. It's more like a poem. It's more like an entryway. It's not a stop. It's not a stop sign. It stops you right there. It's a doorway you open up and you enter into. One of the approaches that is taken by the sources of the Da Vinci Code, and by Brown himself, is to look at these symbols as being signs. It's to reduce them to meaning only one thing. So when he looks at things like a pentagram, it only means goddess worship to him. He looks at these paintings, he accepts only one interpretation of them. And that's one of the cheats and conceits that he uses to carry things along. Some of it is dictated by the structure and form of the thriller, the mystery, and some of it really is more of this persuasive element to get you to accept these backstories as being true. It's one of those things that I sometimes refer to as the esoteric fallacy, and that is that you see a similarity here and here, and you assume that there is a connection between them that is a transmission. That there was a person over here, had this symbol, this meant one thing, and that somehow it was a thread of people, or this information was passed to this other point where it also appears. Now what this belies is more of a vertical connection, that symbols are rich. They come across human cultures, come across out of the blue. Someone has encountered a symbol before in their culture, it isn't live in their culture, and they have a dream about it. These things are a part of us. They're part of that story that is within us. A lot of these symbols resonate because they're deep psychological symbols, what Jung referred to as archetypes. So, one of my pet peeves about this type of approach to this sort of thing is that it undermines that richness and that depth, and it turns these symbols into codes, turns art to having one meaning. Whereas these things are very rich and have a lot of different meanings. Who wants to interrupt at this point? Try to remember to prod you to interrupt more often. Beth.
While I would recognize Christian will be used in other places and other times. That is not at the same time the life of Christian for the super religion. Rather, they rely on the same original source and that all engage in the vertical interpretation of this one source. Therefore, when you come down from the horizontal plane, you're going to find the same.
Yeah.
But the intention is actually to focus on the vertical.
Yeah. Being esoteric doesn't mean that one follows the esoteric fallacy. It's just the only name I could think of for it. Well, the Holy Grail is another interesting thing we can and should look at. And really all the modern stuff that's here is 20th century, 1980s mythology. The Holy Grail really became this symbol that emerged in sort of late medieval time period and became a focus of the troubadour tradition. And then this grew into these written grail myths of Chrétien de Troyes and Wolfram von Eckenbach. And essentially, it becomes this symbol of wholeness. It's the cup of Christ. It's a cup that contains something. It contains the blood of Christ. But this heals, makes one whole. And so this isn't a bloodline. This is a symbol of a religious experience and of a spiritual healing. And this really takes off throughout the Middle Ages. The reference that is made to Sangreal and this arbitrary division and stuff is actually very incorrect. Professor, who was very familiar with medieval French, which I'm not, assures me that the first appearances of Grail are as the word Grail, Graal. There isn't a Sangreal that occurs until fairly later on, 2 centuries later. However, that makes a nice connection. You can tell a story, and it can be a compelling story, and you can convince people, including yourself, that what it's talking about is a physical bloodline. But the mystery of the Grail is really a spiritual, religious experience. And if you look at those who are said to be guardians of the Grail, keepers of the Grail, you have the Templars, and you have the Cathars. These are both somewhat mysterious, esoteric groups that conveyed within their mysteries some different types of initiatory, experiential, sacramental experience. And so what it seems to point to is that when you see symbol of the Grail, what you are seeing is that spiritual wholeness and healing and transformation that can come through an experience of the divine. And the Grail stories point you to that. You have to be prepared. You have to be looking for the right thing. You have to have the right reasons for looking for it. You have to be pure of heart, which is they have to be focused on what you're looking for. And so you could read this as being kind of like an initiatory story, that you are preparing yourself for an initiatory experience through this quest, and then you have it, and that is finding the Grail. However, you're not guaranteed to get it, because many who seek don't find. And to me, that is much more compelling and interesting take on the Grail than a living bloodline or even Mary Magdalene as the wife of Christ. Because that is real and immediate, and we can seek it today. Indeed, we do. Other questions, comments?
What about the Gnostic version, what does it stop?
Yeah, that seems to be the symbol, is the goblet. But that also refers to the chalice of the Eucharist and also to the horn of plenty, the cup of plenty, it was called in Celtic mythology. So it really has this deep resonance. It's a symbol. And to cut the symbol down to say that it is a physical cup is to miss it being a symbol. You know, what's the point of finding a physical cup? Unless it has magical powers that can heal you, but, you know, chances are it's just a cup. Well, it's more about a spiritual wholeness or healing, or psychological wholeness or healing. Because that's the way the story works. You don't get to the Grail until you're prepared. Essentially, the Grail and the Grail quest is just the end, the climax of the story. The whole quest has been the preparation and the transformation. And it is just the end point. In a lot of ways, it's like a sacrament or an initiatory form, like baptism or something, where it's just that experience is just the end point of something. And it isn't meant to convey the whole transformation. It's just meant to be the topping off, that end point. Well, I mean, yeah, it's an initiation, so that means, you know, initiation is the beginning. So, yeah, it's an end point of the transformation. The end point of the transformation is a new beginning, always, yes. So the womb makes a good connection to that. But, I mean, you have these stories, right? The story is never the whole of one's life. It's never the whole of what's happened. But the Grail Quest story is a transformation initiation that takes you through process to the end, where the Grail is the end of that story, but it's just the beginning of what happens next. Anything else?
You know, the whole thing about the bloodline, it's not even an issue to me. I mean, when I think about it, I was like, what if Jesus was married and what if he did have a child? It doesn't affect my faith or my beliefs or anything. You know, I think it's kind of an interesting concept to explore. And I would say, certainly, the issue of whether Jesus is divine or not would have more the ramifications of that in regards to a bloodline to be a greater issue. Mm-hmm. So, I don't...
Yeah, and actually, in the film, they do point that out, that, you know, what does it matter if he did or didn't have children or not? And essentially, in the story we have, the New Testament, the Gospels, are mute on the point, right? They don't include that in the story, so it is irrelevant to the story. The story can be told either way.
And my question, I think that carries over from that is the concept of how was sexuality downplayed in terms of Christ and even in terms of the Bible. So, carrying on from the book, even being portrayed as evil and things. Do you feel like there was the church created a wrong view in that area, or do you feel that what's been espoused is...
There are actually antecedents from before Christianity. And so there do seem to be different threads moving through. And so to the story where it begins with Christianity is wrong, because it actually goes back. I mean, you look at Essenes, which is one of the reasons why Christ may have been celibate, is because there was a tradition of being a sage and essentially being married to the Torah, married to your studies. And so also we have in, you know, Eastern traditions, and also before Christianity in the pagan tradition, you know, there was even not only a celibate, there was a eunuch priesthood that existed. So these are
movements. Sexual rituals, right?
right? I mean, pagans certainly did. And
not very many. And they... Yeah, that is one of the few places where it seems to have really occurred. Other times, there do seem to have occurred fertility rituals. But how much of that you can see as being some larger cultural issue in this is a good question, because, like you say, there's always been a threat, and sometimes it balances one way more, the other way more. But there's never been an absence of either impulse towards having sexuality be a part of religion or having it be removed from religion. They're both always present. What we've had is more of a balancing towards one direction with the formation of early Orthodoxy and the early Roman Catholicism. But it isn't as though it was original there, or this was a new idea then. This is always a part of human experience and religion. Essentially, there's only one religion, the human religion, and there are variations on that. And this is a part of that.
I think Margaret Gardner said that back in the line, it's just like the human struggle, and like they're married. So that's how she believes that Mary experienced Jesus. She traveled.
There are lots of little reasons to believe, but none of them are very compelling. Go through a long list of them, but essentially there was a whole group of people that followed Jesus, and there are listed women and men, and there appears to have been both men and women disciples, and we really don't know anything more than that. I mean, Mary Magdalene may have been an old widow. Right? It's just our imagination that wants to make her a young, beautiful woman that Christ could marry. We have no information except that 7 demons were reported to be cast out from her, and that she apparently had deep pockets. Other than that, her role, resurrection, there isn't a whole lot that's said. In the Gnostic texts, more said that it's about her as a student, as a disciple, and also as a teacher, as an apostle. These have nothing to do with any kind of relationship. So, you say, if the story is mute on the point, it is irrelevant to the story. You can tell the story one way or the other. It's the other stories that you then tell about that story where it becomes important. Or if you tell a story about that story where only men can be priests because there were only male disciples, then you have to play a game with Mary Magdalene and make her somehow not really a disciple.
I think that's why they included in their use of prophecy, because at that time women weren't allowed to travel with men, single women. The law.
Actually, I've not heard that from any of the sources. There's a lot of speculations about the prostitute. The main one that seems to be true is that the stories are together, and it makes narrative sense. You can link them together in your mind. The other things are that Magdala, which means tower in Aramaic, referred to a resort town later on, so it would be like Mary of Las Vegas was one example. But we really don't know. The story really seems to be the reasons that they take place. She's mentioned, then this unnamed woman is mentioned right after. And so the way we do read stories, we make one narrative out of them. And so, make one narrative, Mary Magdalene is this unnamed woman. And as Pope Gregory, who was the first one that we have recorded who made this public connection, but could have been popular imagination long before that. I doubt he came up with something brand new at the time. That's just the way people read these stories and just continue to read on with the same characters when the characters change. Well, does anybody have time? The time. Forget to bring a watch. Okay. That's about where I wanted to talk. So we get to everything, but then there will be more evenings. Any pressing last interests, concerns about these things we've covered so far, these stories? Sponsors? Mm-hmm.
What would be your definition of not? I mean, we already know what the church is in character, not Christ, so what would be your definition?
That would be somebody who focuses on that personal experience and knowing. Whereas in the Orthodox strategy, you have a collective knowing so that you can establish for everyone what's true and what's the correct belief. The Gnostic strategy is more individual. And they both have their pros and cons. Obviously, I'm going to favor the one, but so it's just a different approach entirely. And when you have that personal approach, then the structure outwardly isn't as big of a deal. You don't have to have shared beliefs, one story, one approach. Whereas if you do take that strategy of orthodoxy, you do need those things because that is where you get your right information from and your religious approach from. It's from that outward structure and those authorities and that information. So it's just kind of the reverse of orthodoxy in some ways, and not in others. Essentially, people are involved in all this. Well, it's an approach to religious truth that is personal, and there's a tradition that helps guide one to that experience, and that's the Gnostic tradition. That's where all these texts are, and so forth, and practices that. It's a different approach, sort of coming at it from a different end. But there are joining points. Not completely different things. That satisfy or not?
Well, I mean, scholarship isn't really having a particular definition, right?
No, no. The problem is how do you define art? Well, was Picasso and Michelangelo both artists? Were they both artists? Well, so if you say yes, you then say, okay, well, what's art? Well, there's no answer to that, right? Because art is one of those things that is about gnosis. When we have our two types of knowledge, what the Greeks called episteme and gnosis, things that are in the epistemic category we can define, we can write down, we can draw pictures of. Things that are in the gnosis category we can't. So things like art that are a part of one's subjective experience, you can't define. And you can look at Plato's dialogues as essentially pointing this out in excruciating detail, that things like piety and love and all these things, you can't just rattle off what they are, right? Because once you rattle off a definition, and Socrates can come along, some other wiseacre, and pick it apart and show you that you don't know what you're talking about, because it's a different category of knowledge. And so, what happens is that scholars want to see this episteme, they want information, they want definition, because that's how you go about things as a scholar. But just as no definition of art is ever held up, no definition of Gnosticism is ever held up, and no definition of mysticism, no definition of love. I mean, none of these things that are of this Gnosis category, which, say, Gnosticism is the big daddy of, will have any ability to hang together very well as episteme, as information or book knowledge, facts. And so it's just the nature of the knowledge. What some scholars have said is that you have to have like a musical ear. And there are certain texts, certain things that resonate. And if you read them and they make sense to you, it's because you say that part of that story is within you. And that is a part of the Gnostic story. There's a story called the Hymn of the Pearl, which is kind of the story of every man, every soul. And then the seeker goes from the kingdom of the East into Egypt, seeking a pearl, and forgets what it is he's going after. And what his divine parents do is they send this letter to him. It's both an eagle and a letter. It's a poem. You can do that. And it comes to him, and he reads it. And the way he knows it's true is because it's also written on his own heart. The story was also within him. And that's the way a Gnostic approaches Gnostic scriptures, is not as, here's something out here, do I believe it because some authority or it's a part of a tradition or something, but do I recognize in it? Do I have that story within me as well? And that's the big difference. It's not about information about those things. So it's more like what is not more sort of the deeper thing than what is art, but what is good art. Right? All the funny things about, it's art, but I don't like it, It's art if you like it. All these things that people were talking about in the first part of the 20th century, they're trying to get at what you can't get at in that way. So they just point you in that direction. Another metaphor might be that Zen has been defined as being the finger pointing at the moon. It doesn't tell you anything about the practices of Zen or anything like that, but it does tell you that it is a path, something you can't grasp right now, right here, in this way. And Gnosticism, in a very similar way, is a path or means of getting to what you cannot immediately grasp and hold in that way. So, with that, we will end for this evening. Hopefully you all come back next week. I will beg and cajole if necessary. But I guess we're out of time, so I'll beg and cajole quickly. So, thank you very much. Sure.
The new covenant is one that's written on our heart.
The Gnostic tradition doesn't come out of nowhere.
And the concept of the gospel, even what Paul was referring to, is saying you are living epistles written on and known by man. And I understand, that to me more than just a head knowledge of doctrine or a book or something.
Exactly. Yeah, there are different approaches, but there are connections between. And some figures like Paul, can be seen Gnostically, or from an Orthodox point of view. Figures like Paul can be seen as Gnostic figures, or as Orthodox figures. There's a lot of richness in this tradition, and there isn't any simple division. And there are people who tell the story between Orthodoxy and Gnosticism as if there's only, these two distinct camps. There never were distinct camps. Right? They were always mixing, going together. These ideas always mixing and matching.
Why were the Gnostics put down by the early church?
They didn't fit. They couldn't fit within the Orthodox strategy.
What specifically, though? Certain doctrinal beliefs, or?
Yeah, if you want to have a doctrine, the way that the Orthodox spiritualist believes to the Gnostic text that means doctrine and beliefs. So they were doctrines and beliefs that were in opposition to the doctrines and beliefs that they said. And they didn't fit in that Orthodox strategy, so they couldn't be reconciled.
Are you talking about like the nine commodity? I've never read about the third element and stuff like that. So.
Yeah.
And I
don't know. Yeah. But, they're mostly a lot of world teachings, a lot of person to person communication. So, it wasn't a text, really kind of secondary. Some of them were.
vertex and the other one sort of, yeah, just new scriptures are written and inspiration for him. But when you read these really good fathers going against the Gnostics that you have are then popping out of the honor and their story and these things. And these are wrong stories, right? Because we have a one story that we don't use as our orthodox story. So there isn't,
questions, comments, or suggestions to RevTroy@gnosis.org. Thank you.
information and resources on Gnosticism, visit the Gnosis Archive at gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.ORG.
Wake up.